A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and honestly, it's the kind of prompt that sits with you. He and Hannah have just come through a year that included two wars with Iran, a retaliatory eviction, a grueling move with a one-year-old, and the slow realization that what nearly broke them wasn't any single disaster. It was the fact that they had no margin left when the first domino tipped. And he's asking us to dig into what that word actually means, beyond just having a savings account, and what any family can do to build the kind of buffer that stops a bad year from becoming a catastrophic one.
This hits close to home for me. Not just because we know Daniel and Hannah and little Ezra, but because I spent decades in pediatrics watching families unravel when the buffer ran out. It was never the first thing that got them. It was always the third thing, the fourth thing, the thing that landed when there was nothing left to absorb it. Daniel's obsessive about backup systems for technology, redundant servers, off-site backups, the whole engineering mindset. But it took him this long to apply that same logic to his actual life. Most of us treat our lives like we're running a production server with no failover, just hoping nothing crashes.
The man who backs up his databases, but not his housing situation. There's something almost poetic about that.
We've been trained to think about resilience in machines and not in families. That's a design flaw, a really dangerous one.
Let's name the thing. It's not just a financial concept, and it's not just about taking breaks. It's the deliberate gap between what you can handle and what you're actually carrying. When that gap shrinks to zero, every shock becomes a potential cascade.
Richard Swinson wrote a book called Margin back in 1992 that framed this beautifully. He defined it as the space between our load and our limits. Load is everything that demands something from you. Time, energy, money, emotional bandwidth, physical health. Limits are your actual capacity in each of those dimensions. When load exceeds limits, you're in negative margin. And negative margin is where the spiral lives.
Daniel's year is basically a case study. April of last year, Iran launches over 300 drones and missiles at Israel. That's shock one. Everyone's on edge, sirens, shelters, the whole thing. But you absorb it. You're rattled, but standing.
Then July hits. A leak develops in the apartment. The landlord refuses to fix it. By August, he's signaling the lease won't be renewed. Here's where the mechanism becomes visible. The war stress is already consuming emotional bandwidth. Now you're dealing with a menacing landlord, water damage, and the creeping dread of losing your home. Capacity is being stolen from other systems. You're not sleeping well. You're not focused at work. The financial buffer, if there was one, is getting nibbled away.
The second war with Iran kicks off, longer and more intense than the first. Israeli ground operations in Lebanon intensified strikes on Iranian targets. This one lasts through November. So now you're in active conflict, while also knowing your housing is precarious, while also trying to protect a baby who's just a few months old. That's not three separate problems. That's one problem, force multiplied by the absence of margin.
This is what systems theorists call cascading failure. When one component fails, the load it was carrying gets redistributed to the remaining components. If those components are also near capacity, they fail too, and the load cascades until everything's broken. The classic engineering example is the Texas power grid collapse in 2021. The grid wasn't winterized. That was the missing margin. When the freeze hit, generation capacity dropped, load spiked, and the system cascaded into blackouts that affected 4.5 million homes and killed at least 246 people. It wasn't the cold that killed the grid, it was the absence of buffer.
That's exactly what played out in Daniel's life. The war steals cognitive bandwidth. The landlord steals time and emotional energy. The housing scramble steals financial resources. Each shock redistributes the load to systems already at capacity. By the time the ceasefire was concluded in December, they weren't recovering. They were just finding new ways to be depleted.
There's a psychological mechanism that makes this even more insidious. Mullanathan and Shafir wrote about this in their book, Scarcity. When you're in a state of scarcity, money, time, emotional reserves, your cognitive bandwidth gets consumed by triage. You're constantly putting out fires, which means you have no executive function left for the long-term planning that would actually build margin. It's a trap. The very thing that would save you becomes impossible because you're too busy drowning.
The poor stay poor and the stressed stay stressed. It's not a moral failing. It's a bandwidth problem.
This is why Daniel's question is so important. He's asking what could have stopped the spiral, and the answer isn't just save more money. It's build margin in multiple dimensions so that when one system gets hit, the others don't immediately buckle. Financial margin is part of it. 3 to 6 months of expenses is the standard advice. But there's also temporal margin, deliberately under-scheduling, so a crisis doesn't derail everything. Relational margin, having people you can call at 2 in the morning, which requires investing in those relationships before you need them. Logistical margin, backup plans for housing, childcare, transportation.
Here's the thing that really sticks with me from Daniel's prompt. He says they don't have parents helping with childcare. That's a relational and logistical margin that a lot of families rely on without even realizing it. When you don't have it, every other shock lands harder because there's no one to take the baby while you deal with the landlord, or scroll through rental listings, or just sit in a quiet room for 10 minutes and remember how to breathe.
That missing margin amplifies everything, and most people don't realize they lack margin until they're already in the spiral because the absence of buffer is invisible during normal operation. When things are going fine, running at 95% capacity looks the same as running at 60%. You're getting everything done. But the moment a shock hits, the difference becomes catastrophic.
This is where the engineering mindset Daniel already has for his tech life becomes genuinely useful. In software, we have chaos engineering. Netflix introduced Chaos Monkey back in 2011. It randomly terminates production instances to test whether the system can handle failure gracefully. You break things on purpose during normal operation, so you know what fails before a real crisis exposes it. Most of us never run that simulation with our lives. What happens if I lose my job? What happens if war breaks out? What happens if my landlord evicts me? We just assume the happy path will hold.
When it doesn't, we discover our single points of failure in real time, under maximum stress, with no buffer. It's a terrible way to learn that your emergency fund is theoretical rather than actual.
Daniel's story makes this painfully concrete. If he'd had a prearranged emergency fund of even 2 months' rent, the eviction wouldn't have triggered a financial crisis on top of the war stress. If he'd had a pre-vetted list of backup rentals, built during a calm period, the housing scramble would have taken days instead of weeks. These aren't huge interventions. They're small margins. And once you're in the spiral, even a small parachute changes the trajectory.
That's the phrase that really landed for me. It's not about being invulnerable. It's about having enough buffer that the first domino doesn't automatically knock over the second. A week of expenses in a separate account. A week of meals in the pantry. One prearranged backup childcare option. These are not wealthy person luxuries. These are accessible margins that most people can build incrementally.
The irony, which Daniel himself names, is that he was already doing this for his servers. He just hadn't applied the same logic to his life. We'll spend hours configuring offsite backups and failover clusters, and then our actual family's resilience plan is, hope nothing bad happens.
Hope is not a strategy. I've said that to parents in my clinic more times than I can count, and margin isn't pessimism. It's about creating the conditions where you can take risks and seize opportunities because you know you can absorb the downside. A family with margin can say yes to a career change or a move. A family without margin can't say yes to anything because they're just trying not to fall apart.
The question Daniel's really asking is, how do you build margin when you're already at capacity? How do you create buffer when the scarcity trap has you in its teeth and every day is triage?
The answer starts with something counterintuitive. You don't try to build the full emergency fund overnight. You build the smallest possible buffer first. The one-week parachute. Because small margins compound, and they buy you the cognitive bandwidth to build bigger ones. In medicine, when a patient is in acute crisis, you don't start with long-term treatment. You stabilize first. You stop the bleeding. Then you can think about physical therapy.
Stabilize, then strengthen. Same principle. Whether you're talking about a power grid or a family budget or a nervous system that's been running on adrenaline for 11 months.
That's where we're going next. Because understanding the mechanism of the spiral is one thing. Actually building the buffers that break the cascade, especially when you're already depleted, that's the part that matters.
Let's define the thing properly before we start building it. Margin is the deliberate gap between capacity and load. Not a happy accident, not a windfall. It's engineered space. And the key word is deliberate, because the default setting of modern life is to fill every gap the moment it appears.
Swinson was writing in a pre-smartphone world, and the problem has only accelerated. What Daniel's year illustrates is that in 2026, the loads don't arrive one at a time anymore. You're dealing with a war while your phone is pinging rental alerts, while your toddler needs lunch, while your bank account is draining. The loads stack, and if there's no gap between any of them and your actual capacity, the whole thing folds.
Rebuild this gap into machines as a matter of basic competence. Nobody runs a server at 99% CPU utilization and calls it good engineering. You'd be laughed out of the room. You build in headroom. You provision for spikes. The entire discipline of systems reliability is essentially the science of margin.
Redundant power supplies. Geographic redundancy for cloud storage. Entire industries devoted to making sure Netflix doesn't go down for 5 minutes, and yet the average family is running with no buffer in any dimension. We've externalized the engineering mindset to our tools and forgotten to apply it to ourselves.
Part of it is that machines give us dashboards. You can see the CPU graph. Human capacity doesn't come with a little red alert that says, emotional reserves at 12%, schedule maintenance window. We just feel it vaguely as exhaustion or that specific kind of dread that shows up at 3 in the morning. By the time you feel it, you're already in negative margin.
That's the invisibility problem. During normal operation, running at 90% capacity looks identical to running at 60%. The dishes are washed, the emails are answered, the baby is fed. The absence of buffer is completely hidden until a shock lands. Then suddenly, the difference between 60 and 90% is the difference between absorbing the shock and cascading.
Which brings us to the cascade mechanism itself. Each bad thing stole capacity from the systems that were supposed to handle the next bad thing. The war consumed emotional bandwidth. That left less bandwidth for dealing with the landlord. Dealing with the landlord consumed time and money. That left less for work. Reduced work output created financial strain. Financial strain made the housing surge more desperate. Round and round, each failure redistributing its load to systems already at their limit.
Systems engineers call this brittle failure. When a system has no margin, it doesn't degrade gracefully. One component fails. The load shifts to adjacent components. They fail because they were already near capacity, and the whole thing collapses in a chain reaction. The opposite is graceful degradation. A system with margin loses one component, but continues functioning at reduced capacity. The lights dim, but they don't go out.
That's the difference between a hard year and a catastrophic one. Daniel's family didn't just have a hard year. They had a hard year where every shock landed on a system that was already maxed out. There was no slack anywhere to absorb the impact.
The Texas grid collapse makes the mechanism visible. In February 2021, winter storm Uri hit. ERCOT had designed the system with almost no winterization margin. When temperatures dropped to single digits, generation plants started tripping offline. Each plant that failed shifted its load to the remaining plants, which were already running near capacity because demand was spiking. Those plants overloaded and tripped. Within hours, a cascade knocked out power to 4.5 million homes and killed at least 246 people. Nobody at ERCOT woke up that morning thinking they were running without margin. The system had handled cold snaps before. It looked fine during normal operation. It was only when the shock arrived that the absence of buffer revealed itself.
This is where the psychological dimension gets critical, because it's not just about money or time. It's about cognition. Mullinathan and Shafir's work on scarcity documented that when you're in a state of scarcity, your effective IQ drops. Not because you're less intelligent, but because your cognitive bandwidth is being consumed by the immediate crisis. They found the effect size was equivalent to losing a full night's sleep.
You're not dumber, you're tunnel-visioned. Your brain is doing exactly what it's supposed to do in a crisis, focusing on the immediate threat and filtering out everything else. The problem is that everything else includes the long-term planning that would actually get you out of the crisis. That's the scarcity trap. The bandwidth you need to build margin is consumed by the lack of margin.
Which explains why Daniel's question is so hard to answer from inside the spiral. When you're in it, your brain has literally narrowed your field of vision to the next 24 hours. You're not thinking about a pre-vetted rental list or a 2-month emergency fund. You're thinking about whether the sirens are going to go off tonight and whether you have enough diapers for the week.
Triage mode is exhausting. There's a concept called decision fatigue. Every decision you make depletes a shared cognitive resource. By the end of a day in crisis mode, you've made hundreds of high-stakes decisions with incomplete information, and your decision-making apparatus is fried. That's when people sign a lease they shouldn't sign or miss a deadline or snap at their spouse.
The marriage takes damage. Daniel mentioned that he and Hannah feel broken on multiple levels. That's not just physical exhaustion or financial strain. That's relational margin being depleted. When you're both in triage mode, you don't have the bandwidth to be generous with each other. Every minor friction becomes a major conflict because there's no buffer left for patience or grace.
I saw this repeatedly in my practice. Families would come in, and the presenting problem was the child's health, but underneath you could see the whole system straining. The parents weren't sleeping, they were missing work, they were fighting more. The medical issue was the shock that revealed the absence of margin in every other dimension, and the families that weathered it best weren't necessarily the wealthiest. They were the ones with relational buffers, a grandmother who could take the other kids, a neighbor who could bring meals, a workplace that offered flexibility.
Which brings us back to Daniel's specific vulnerability. No parents helping with childcare. That's a relational margin many families depend on without recognizing it as infrastructure. When you don't have it, every other shock lands harder. It's like running a server without a load balancer. Every request hits the same machine until it melts.
The cruelest part is that building relational margin requires time and energy. You have to invest in friendships before you need them. But when you're already at capacity, the first thing that gets cut is social connection, because it feels optional. It's not. It's a critical buffer, and you don't realize how critical until you need it, and it's not there.
The cascade has a shape. Shock 1 lands on a system with no margin. That system fails and redistributes its load to adjacent systems, which were also near capacity. Those systems buckle, consuming cognitive bandwidth, degrading decision-making, leading to worse outcomes, which create new shocks. And all of this happens while the original shock is still unfolding, because wars don't pause while you deal with your landlord. The shocks don't take turns. We know the mechanism. Now the hard part. What do you actually do about it, especially when you're already depleted?
The first practical step is uncomfortable. Run your own chaos monkey. Identify the 3 biggest single points of failure in your life: housing, income, childcare, health insurance. Then ask the question most of us avoid: if this failed tomorrow, what's my buffer? If the answer is nothing, that's your margin-building priority. Not because you're paranoid, because you're engineering the system.
You have to be honest in that simulation. The point isn't to reassure yourself that things would probably work out. The point is to find the gaps before a real shock finds them for you.
Second, build the smallest possible margin first. Don't try to save 6 months of expenses overnight. That's overwhelming and you'll quit. Start with a 1-week buffer. 1 week of expenses in a separate account. 1 week of meals in the pantry. 1 pre-arranged backup child care option. Small margins compound. They buy you the cognitive bandwidth to build bigger ones.
The 1-week pantry thing is interesting because it's so tangible. You can do it in a single grocery trip. When the next shock hits, whether it's a war or a snowstorm or just a week where everything goes wrong, you're not also scrambling for food while you deal with everything else.
Same logic with the 1-week expense buffer. It's not going to save you from a job loss, but it absorbs the small shocks, the unexpected car repair, the medical copay, the week your freelance check is late. Those small shocks are the ones that trigger the cascade when there's no buffer. If you can absorb the first hit, the second one never lands.
Third, treat margin as a system, not a goal. A goal is something you achieve and then stop thinking about. A system requires maintenance. Set a quarterly margin review. Put it on your calendar. Check your buffers. Has your financial margin eroded because expenses crept up? Has your relational margin atrophied because you haven't seen certain friends in 6 months? Has your logistical margin gone stale because those backup rental listings are now outdated?
This is the part people skip. They build the emergency fund, feel good about it, and 3 years later, inflation has eaten half of it and they haven't adjusted. Margin decays if you don't maintain it. The quarterly review is the maintenance window.
The goal of all of this isn't to be invulnerable. That's not possible. The goal is to absorb one shock without it becoming a cascade. Just the first one. Because if you can stop the first domino, the rest never fall.
Daniel's year wasn't one disaster. It was one disaster that cascaded into five because there was no buffer anywhere in the system. If any single margin had been in place, the two-month rent fund, or the pre-vetted rental list, or a local friend who could take Ezra for an afternoon, the whole trajectory changes. You don't need to be bulletproof. You need one parachute.
The time to pack the parachute is now. Not when you're already falling. One last thought before we wrap. Daniel's family survived this year. And there's a temptation, when you come through something like that, to frame it as a story of grit or resilience. But that's not what this is. The goal isn't to be heroic. The goal is to build systems so that when the next war or leak or eviction comes, you have the margin to absorb it without breaking. That's not pessimism. It's engineering.
It's the same engineering instinct Daniel already applies to his servers and his code. He just hadn't ported it over to his life yet. Most of us haven't. We treat personal resilience as a character trait instead of a design problem. But it is a design problem. It has inputs and outputs and failure modes and recovery procedures. And the central insight is that margin isn't a luxury you build after everything else is handled. It is the thing that lets you handle everything else.
Here's the question I want to leave people with. What would it look like if we treated our lives with the same rigor we apply to our production systems? What if personal uptime was a metric we actually designed for, instead of just crossing our fingers and hoping the happy path holds? Because the happy path never holds. The shocks come. The question is whether you've built the buffer to absorb them, or whether you're going to discover your single points of failure in real time, under maximum load, with no margin left.
If this episode resonated with you, if you've had your own experience where a small buffer saved you, or where the lack of one taught you something hard, we want to hear it. Send us your margin story. What worked, what didn't, what you wish you'd built before the crisis hit. We'll read the best ones in a future episode.
Because Daniel's prompt came from a hard place, but the conversation it sparked is one that a lot of families need right now. You're not alone in running at 98% capacity and hoping nothing breaks. But you can start building the buffer today, even the smallest one.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1840s, French Guiana's colonial administration imported an elaborate mechanical clock tower to keep civil time in Cayenne, but the tropical humidity warped the wooden gears so severely that the clock reliably gained exactly 11 minutes per day. Rather than repair it, officials simply recalibrated the town's entire schedule around the fast clock for over 30 years. Inadvertently creating a local time zone that lagged 11 minutes further behind Paris each day until noon drifted past sunset.
So they just decided time was a suggestion.
30 years of collective jet lag. That's unsettling. This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you've got a margin story or a question you want us to dig into, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.